Lhasa. So this morning I'd like to return to the shamatha practice of metta bhavana, or the meditative cultivation of loving kindness. And I emphasized a couple of days ago the immediate trigger or catalyst, that which immediately arouses such genuine loving kindness. So we're very familiar with that, the quality, that quality of lovable quality or lovability. There's another crucial element, though, in Buddhaghosa's brilliant analysis of each of the four immeasurables, and now specifically with respect to loving kindness, and that is for each of the four immeasurables, he highlights what he calls the near enemy, that which can easily be mistaken for the sublime virtue of any of these four immeasurables. And as I think many of you know, the near enemy, or the false facsimile in modern terminology, the false facsimile of loving kindness is self-centered attachment. So it's attachment. Attachment's all about appearances. One can be attached to a car, a place, beautiful Tuscany, attached to one's reputation, one's physical appearance, the personality of another person's voice, another person's, and so forth. Appearances. And so pleasant appearances arouse attachment. Unpleasant appearances arouse aversion and hostility. And neutral appearances arouse ignorance. We ignore them. We don't find them interesting. They're neither threat nor are they something that could be a benefit to us. And therefore, we can afford to ignore neutral things, right? The pleasant has the promise of some pleasure coming. The unpleasant holds a threat of pain coming. The neutral, uninteresting, therefore to be ignored. And so we can see how we can apply this to people. People, appearances. Pleasant people, pleasant in any way. Obviously physically attractive is one possibility, but people can be pleasant or attractive in a myriad of ways, including virtue. When people are very virtuous, when they're displaying kindness, generosity, and so forth and so on, that we find that very pleasant, and it's very easy to be attached to such people. Not just their, you know, their attractiveness, but also virtue. And conversely, of course, if people are manifesting very unvirtuous, non-virtuous behavior, that can easily arouse aversion, hatred, hostility, contempt, and so on. And as this is true for those that we attend to outwards, those around us in the surrounding society, likewise, of course, when we attend to the space of our own minds, we attend to the society of our own minds, then we see these multiple manifestations of ourselves. And some of them we may find quite pleasing. We may look in on the most superficial level. We may look into the mirror and like what we see, and then be attached to our physical appearance, you know, feeling good about ourselves. The whole issue of extreme makeovers, whole issues of weight loss, of whole issues of cosmetic surgery and so forth and so on, to make people feel better about themselves, so they like themselves or more pleased with themselves. It's all about appearances. It's all about attachment. It has nothing to do with loving kindness. And likewise, when we look into the mirror and we see something unpleasant, whatever aspect of our physical appearance we find unpleasant, it's the same thing. It's just aversion. Or just we find ourselves neither attractive nor unattractive, then we just find boring and we ignore. But going deeper than that, just, you know, flesh and bone, just the physical appearances, we know that much more important to us, for most, I think almost everybody, more important than just the outer appearances is this person appealing or unappealing, right? Is the person appealing or unappealing? And then we're looking for behavior, attitudes, ways of expressing themselves and so forth. And then similarly, ourselves. So as we direct the mind inwards, and this is very, very much a contemplative, an inwardly directed contemplative route that we're following here on the Shamatha Vipassana Mahamudra track. As we direct our awareness inwards upon ourselves and the various ways we've manifested on so many occasions throughout the course of our lives, setting aside the physical, which is, again, the most superficial, going deeper, there are certainly moments, if your life at all like mine, moments when we think back of ways we behave, we engage with others, the way we were simply present in the world, the way we appeared, that we're quite happy with, quite pleased with ourselves, you know, proud of ourselves. And of course, this can also lead to a sense of superiority, that I was really quite exceptional. It can lead to narcissism, a self-satisfaction. And it's all attending to appearances. Appearances, right? And the appearances of one's intelligence or one's generosity or kindness or skill in this or that or another thing, and be quite pleased with ourselves. And then one can easily mistake that for self-directed loving kindness, where in fact it's self-infatuation. It's self-centered attachment. Because one is pleased with the appearances, right? And the appearances come and go. And then on other occasions, we have all these phrases in English, and I think you'll find them in other European languages, self-loathing, self-contempt, self-hatred, low self-esteem, lack of self-worth. How many words are there? You know, and the psychologists are so well aware of this, because I think a lot of your clients, a lot of your patients, will be suffering from various forms of this, of just the multiple permutations of just a lack of self-worth. But we have all these variations, many of which can't even be translated into Tibetan, just because it just didn't seem to be so prominent in that traditional culture. But then again, coming back not just to those people over there who are suffering from low self-esteem and self-hatred, unlike myself, we can think, if you're all like me, you can think back to occasions in your life where you look at these episodes, how you manifested the behavior, the appearance, the way you spoke, the way you acted, the kind of attitudes, thought process, and so forth that you manifested. And you may be just disgusted. I mean, embarrassed, disgusted, feeling humiliated, and feeling even like, you know, that episode, overall, do I hate myself? No, but boy, in that episode, that guy was disgusting. Or that was, looking for D word, despicable. That was one of my worst days. That was a bad period. That person really, ugh, can't stand that person. I'm okay, but that one there, like that, you know, because we have so many permutations. Maybe some of you are more homogeneously, it's just nice. But when I, you know, when you've been 66 years, it's not homogeneously nice. So we can look back on these appearances and find some that we feel very embarrassed of, or humiliated by, or really quite self-loathed. Self-loathing. Just don't like myself. I certainly didn't like myself at that age. And then many, many others, we just look back and say, nothing attractive, nothing virtuous, nothing unattractive, nothing non-virtuous, boring. And we just find ourselves boring, and therefore can ignore. It's just kind of aloof indifference, self-directed aloof indifference. Right? Can all happen, yeah? And so all of these are flack. Flack. And that is where, this is a terrible metaphor, I'm going to use it anyway, it just comes to mind. And that is, I've seen in movies, when a missile is coming in to like a ship, from a hostile ship, for example, a missile's coming in, then they'll send up flak to try to detonate the missile in midair, right? Very common. I think it's been going on a long time. Then the missile never strikes home, right? And you're safe. But it's flak. It's something that deflects. And then the whole issue is, you know, it didn't work. Well, we're sending a missile now, a benevolent missile, into our Buddha nature. And up comes the flak. As we seek to go deeply into our own substrate consciousness, into Buddha nature, up comes the flak of pleasant appearances, unpleasant appearances, boring, neutral appearances. And then we get derailed, and that's where loving kindness gets derailed. It blows up. It goes neutral. It self-detonates. In mere self-centered attachment. And in English, and I think it's Europe, I think it's much more widespread than that, but I know our language, English language, quite well. And the conflation is almost universal. You can't truly love without setting yourself up for heartbreak. Anybody ever heard that one? You have to be courageous to love. Because you know that it makes you vulnerable and heartbreak and so forth. And the other person may disappoint you and so forth. But be bold, be courageous, have attachment and hope it works out well. And even if it doesn't and there's heartbreak at the end, well, it was worth it before the heartbreak hit, wasn't it? conflation, total conflation, almost universal conflation. You find it's not conflated in Christianity when you really go deep. You don't have to go that deeply. But unconditional love, the love of Jesus, that's not self-centered attachment. That's not self-centered. So it's there. It's there in the wisdom traditions. But in our common vernacular, love is completely conflated. Loving kindness where there is affection. So it's not saying, you know, romantic love is just stupid, goofball, crazy. No, in fact, it often has strong elements of genuinely caring for the other person, loving kindness for the person, affection for the person, self-sacrifice for the other person. That can be all built in, right? We know that. People who are deeply in love may make strong sacrifices for each other. And even when the other one is, you know, throwing up and really disgusting, the love is still there, you know? So it's not just good guys and bad guys. But we completely can conflate this of the love which is really self-centered attachment with loving kindness. And we put it in one word, L-O-V-E. You know. And Buddhism, the Buddha himself, and Buddhaghosa, and all of the great Buddhist masters, homogeneously, have so clearly defined, here is self-centered attachment, here is the definition of attachment, and it has nothing to do with loving kindness. And here is loving kindness, and it's completely empty of self-centered attachment. They bring in, like brain surgeons, they bring in the scalpel and say, look, if you have, insofar as you have a relationship with another person or yourself that is fundamentally one of self-centered attachment, it may feel very good for a while, and it will lead to heartbreak. It is not sustainable. It's not a sustainable type of happiness, right? Whereas you have loving kindness for yourself or loving kindness for another person, it's not a time bomb waiting to fall into heartbreak, disappointment, loss, and all of that. Not at all. I mean, there's no downside to loving kindness at all. Never. And there's always a downside with self-centered attachment because it's built into it. That's an enormously important distinction. And it's not out there in the air. Show me in the popular media where this distinction is made, even in psychology. I don't know. But in Buddhism, crystal clear. So we see the flak, that which is, as we seek to cultivate loving kindness, the flak that comes up that can make that endeavor just go like that, you know. Just go awry. Because we're so caught up, especially in this materialistic era, we're so caught up in appearances. Appearances all the way through. To the point that saying robots are conscious because they appear to be conscious. We're not conscious because we could be robots. You know. I mean, there are people, General Dennett said we are mindless robots made of mindful robots. And he's not crazy. And he has followers who believe that. Ray Kurzweil says the next stage of human evolution, when we hit the singularity, is we're going to transmute into robots. You know? And so, you know, there's a lot of, by intelligent people, Ray Kurzweil, head of research and development for Google. You don't get that position by being stupid. You know, very brilliant man, but he really does think we're already robots and we just have to be better ones, you know. And so it's all appearances. It's all appearances. That taboo of subjectivity has really struck deeply into the very core of our modern civilization. And we are going right into the core of subjectivity in this whole track of Shamatha Vipassana and then the Mahamudra. So to not be beguiled, misled, derailed by appearances. As a mother may love her child, and that love for the child may be totally bound up with self-centered attachment. Totally fused, like bacon is fused with fat. You know? It can just have so much self-centered attachment. My child. And then when does that love really come up? When the child's just adorable. We've all seen adorable. Who doesn't smile like Ursula smiling right now? When you just see an adorable child chuckling and giggling away and, you know, cooing and doing all those little things that little children do. You just kind of take one look. Oh, they're so adorable. You're adorable. And then... during the time of the terrible twos, and then for the rest of the life. The time with the child is just like, give me a break. Would you quit whining? Would you quit screaming? Would you quit just doing everything you're doing? Because it's so annoying. And would you like to go up for adoption, at least for a little while? Because the way you're appearing to me is like, give me a break. I'm so exhausted with you. You just can never be pleased. And you want to just be always contrary. No, 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 no. You're no longer adorable. Get over it. So even with children, you know, they will appear, infants, children, adolescents, right through to, you know, death do us part, appear adorable on some occasions and then quite unadorable, quite annoying or disgusting on other occasions. This one lovely Mexican woman living in Los Angeles, I quote her very often. She's a very loving mother and she has lovely daughters now, I think late teens, early adulthood. But she said when she had like three daughters all clustered at the same age. And so when she had these three daughters and they're all quite young, she said she'd look at her daughters and she said they were just so adorable I wanted to munch them. I just wanted to chew and gobble them up, you know. They're just so adorable, you know, these cute little girls. And then as they got older and older into teenagers, and then she said, and sometimes when I look at them as teenagers, I wish I had. And her daughters, by the way, have turned out very, very well. I've met them as young adults. They're lovely people. But I think we all relate to that. That's why we're laughing. We don't think, oh, what a weirdo, or I guess those Mexican moms are terrible. No, we all recognize that. So we come back to this theme of the lovable, what is lovable? Well, children giggling, playing, happy, healthy, and so forth, that's lovable, but then they're not. And we ourselves display on occasion being lovable. Otherwise, no one would ever love us. And then on occasion, not, right? And so there's positive, negative, and then there's just neutral, where just that, nothing special. So we see the classic mode that I would say is a religious mode of Maitreya, of a Sangha, as setting out on the path of bodhicitta. And it's a religious mode in the sense that it's relying on assertions that we take on the basis of authority. And that's what religion people always do. Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim. That there's an authority. It's a prophet, it's a son of God, it's a Buddha, it's an arhat. But this authority, and it's not something that in the foreseeable future you have any way of possibly verifying for yourself, but you have sufficient faith in the Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita, the Pali Canon, and so forth, that you say, well, I regard this as an authority. I regard the person behind it, or the being, the supreme being behind it, as an authority. Therefore, yes, I will bet my life on this, because that's what religious people do. And so do atheists and materialists. They're betting their life on another authority. It doesn't crystallize around one person, like Thomas Huxley or any other atheist, but they are also relying on authority, right? So there's a religious route. And for those moderners who either are in the modern world raised in a Buddhist culture or have a lot of momentum, karmic momentum from past life, then these classic traditional teachings that we find in the Lamrim, we find all over Mahayana Buddhism, all said, you've had countless, limitless past lives in beginning with samsara. It's going to be hard to check that one. Do we have 10, 20, 1 million, 133,229, or is there more? It's going to be hard to test that one in the foreseeable future. So there's one statement. You accept it on authority or not, but it's going to be hard to test, right? In limitless previous lives. And then in limitless previous lives, in this universe with 100 billion galaxies, all sentient beings have at one time or another been your mother, without exception. Every single one has been. Okay. All right, you accept it or you don't, but it's religious faith. And I say that with no sarcasm, no nothing, but it is religious faith. To be able to test that, not in the near future. Right. So if one has that faith, and it's very firm faith, irreversible faith, then if it is, then that can be the foundation for developing loving kindness, the sense of gratitude to all sentient beings, the affinity with all sentient beings, and developing loving kindness, compassion, and proceeding right on to bodhicitta. It can, it has. Still does, still can. But if you don't have that kind of faith, and we do have a problem in modernity, I think everybody in this room, probably everybody listening by podcast, we've been exposed to multiple authorities. I was raised in a Christian family, very, very Christian, father being a theologian. But then I was immersed in science. I got more authorities to deal with. We're teaching something, a worldview, very different than what I heard once a week. 5 days a week in school, I heard one worldview. 1 day a week on Sundays got a very, very different worldview. So then I was exposed to multiple authorities, right? And then, let alone hearing about other religions, oh, you mean not everybody's Christian or everybody's Protestant. I'm not sure about those Roman Catholics. They're not quite Christian, not quite sure. It's a bit dodgy because they're not quite like us Protestants, you know? And then many Roman Catholics think, kind of, oh, you Protestants, a near miss, but a nice try, but you know. You didn't follow the one true church, let alone those Jews. I don't think they're even trying to become Christian. They just missed the boat. What are you waiting for? The Messiah has come. Why don't you jump aboard, you know, pop aboard? And then those heathen, oh my goodness, those pagans, those heathen off in Asia, they don't even believe in Abraham or the one true God. I mean, they're really out to lunch. But they think they're at their authority. So by the time we're exposed to these multiple authorities, it's hard to have very, very kind of irreversible faith in authority. Not impossible. But we are exposed more than ever before to plurality, pluralism, in terms of the authorities that we may embrace or not. So a more empirical approach, where the knowledge is not so distant, is this approach here. It's the approach of Shantideva, Maitreya, Manjushri, and Shantideva. The approach here, and that is, as we're seeking out the lovable quality, that something deeper than, more abiding than, the appearances that are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, arousing attachment, aversion, and indifference. What's deeper than that? And this, I want to keep this close to the heart this morning. Because if we haven't sorted out ourselves, if we haven't developed an abiding in a sense of loving kindness for ourselves that is not fair weather loving kindness for ourselves, fine as long as we're in retreat and we're living with lovely people and we're kind of pretty lovely ourselves, but then we step out and we're not surrounded by Dharma practitioners and we're not always manifesting in accordance with Dharma, and sometimes we deplore the way we respond to each other, other people, situations, and we respond with regret and then feeling guilt and feeling like, oh, you know, I'm still such a failure in Dharma. Then loving kindness for oneself can just wither on the vine, you know. And it can wither the day we leave this retreat, as soon as then we're behaving in ways that are not lovable, right? And if our sense of loving kindness for ourselves is fair weather, comes and goes, depending on how are you today? How are you appearing today? Are you lovable today? What have you done for me recently? That kind of thing. Then, if that basis of loving, self-directed loving kindness is wobbly, flaky, come and go, up and down, then there's no hope. Really, I think there's really literally no hope that the sense of loving kindness for others will be in any way sustainable. That nice word, sustainable economy, sustainable well-being, sustainable loving kindness. I think there's no chance. If it's not sustainable inwardly directed, where we can see our thoughts and our emotions and our mental afflictions and so forth, if that's not sustainable, if we dislike ourselves as soon as the mental afflictions come and take charge of the mind, and maybe even come out the mouth and so forth, then what chance do we have? I think like that of a snowball in a hot hell. We have to have that caveat in Buddhism. Snowballs in cold hells, they can last a long time. Snowballs in hot hells, very short lifespan. So what can we do? Because as much as we'd like to say, well, what am I going to do? I'm just going to be good from now on. I'm going to be pleasant and likable from this day forward because I never want to be unlikable. I always want to like myself. And I'm going to be always likable and always pleasant and always nice. And I'm just going to go, I'm going to ride that wave of niceness and pleasant appearances. Even we could, and there's some people who their virtue is so deep, the great bodhisattvas, their virtue is so deep, they don't have bad days. They don't have mean-spirited days. I mean, it's true. There are such noble people, mahasattvas, great beings. Yeah. But if that's all we got, if we should arise to that level, and our whole loving-kindness is based upon our pleasant appearances, our virtuous appearances, how's that going to turn out when we turn our attention to other people? And say, whoa, I'm just maintaining a constant stream of virtue here, but you're not. You were nice yesterday, but today you stink. And I was nice yesterday, and I'm nice today, but boy, you really are in the trash can today. Man, I can't stand you. At least I'm not I'm okay, you're not okay. You know. And so one might have this facade, this false facsimile of loving kindness for oneself. Of course, that's going to collapse as soon as you direct the attention outwards. Because the world around us, it doesn't seem like it's at any point in the near future going to be arising with just virtuous, kind people happening all the time. We may have to wait for a long time for that to happen. So there has to be something deeper than pleasant appearances. If this loving kindness, we're starting there. I mean, that's the base of the pyramid, right? Immeasurable loving kindness. Then we go to compassion. We start moving up into the greats, and then finally bodhicitta. But the foundation is down here, right? And if the foundation is all a mixture of self-centered attachment and genuine loving kindness, anything built on that sandy foundation is going to be just as unsustainable. So I think the foundations are really, really important, aren't they? That it has to be, when we know what we're cultivating, it's cultivating loving kindness, and it's not an alloy or a mixture of, 75% loving kindness, 25% self-centered attachment. So how's that possible? And I think here's a way that doesn't require some very deep faith, religious faith, in such things as countless past lives. All sentient beings have indeed been our mothers. What is the way of abiding? You remember this, it really struck me for the first time, and I haven't seen this text for a long time, but as you are resting in meditative equipoise, so he's assumed you've achieved shamatha, or something very similar to it, right? From the state of equipoise, like that minnow swimming through the water, the clear water, the limpid water, then you examine niluk. Another way of translating is your way of being present. Ne means to be present, to be abiding, to be there. How are you present? How do you appear? And then how do you apprehend yourself? I think I've never seen that anywhere else. And it's very much in tune with the Mahamudra. It shows he's really doing a deep fusion here of the classic Gagyu Mahamudra approach, which I've never seen, I've never seen that in the Mahamudra. But nor is it classic Galupa, where first of all you intellectually identify the subtle object of negation, then you apply analysis to it. It's not that either. It's resting in meditative equipoise, and from that basis, examining introspectively your own presence. How are you present? How do you appear? And how do you apprehend yourself? How are you present once you've achieved shamatha and you're simply present there? Presence in the bhavanga, just resting in that bhavanga. How are you present? And here's what the Buddha said. I'm reading this now for a second time, and hopefully we'll see it afresh, as if for the first time. Here's what the Buddha said of resting in the bhavanga. And what that bhavanga is like, that ground of becoming. He said, I know of no other single process which thus developed and made much of, is pliable and workable as is this citta. Pliable and workable. When developed and made much of, when developed, cultivated, is so pliable, so workable as this citta. In other words, you can be a mass murderer like Milarepa with some very deeply ingrained resentment, hostility, vengeance, and so forth. His mind was conditioned in that way. But then when he cultivated and developed it, even a mind that is deeply ingrained, deeply habituated to greed, hostility, malevolence, and so forth, the Buddha himself says, I see nothing more workable, malleable, transformable than the human mind. I think he's referring to minerals and lumber and rocks and the five elements and so forth, nothing is as malleable as the mind itself. You know, that's incredibly inspiring. That whatever your past is, this is your mind. There's a nice phrase from the Christian tradition. Every saint has a past, and every sinner has a future. I like that one a lot. I really like that one a lot. And so nothing more pliable or workable as this chitta. This chitta is the bhavanga. Amongst the chitta which is thus developed and made much of, developed and cultivated, is pliable and workable. There's hope. There's an enormous hope here. However you regard yourself, however you regard your mind, however your conditioning of your mind may be, there is hope, enormous hope. Monks, I know of no other single process so quick to change as is this chitta. And that can happen. I know, again, I've been listening for a long, long time. A person may be on one track, one life, entirely hedonic, all about, you know, the extrinsic values of money, wealth, prestige, and so forth, and power. And then, you've all heard this, it's really rather common. Then the person has a terrible automobile accident, comes to within just a hair's breadth of death, right? Survives, and then everything changes. You know, we've all heard that. Or a person who almost dies of cancer, and then, or a person who goes through another kind of trauma, maybe the loss of one's whole family, or other, you know, traumatic events. They don't always turn out this way or that way, but on occasion, there'll be so much momentum, and then so quick, one thing changes, and then the person's whole worldview, set of values, way of life dramatically changes. And why? Mind changes. And the speech and behavior, that just follows suit. But one event like that can change everything. You can meet one person. This also happens. It doesn't have to be traumatic. But the individuals, I'll tell you one example, and they're very public. I'm going on and on here, but I love this material. Lama Yeshe, who's the head lama of the Samye Ling in Scotland. He's a lovely lama. I got to know him a bit. And when he was in his adolescence and young adulthood, he was the playboy's playboy, drugs and party. His older brother was a great tuku, and all those other tukus that were in his older brother's club, they said, whatever, don't become like his little brother. You know, Yeshe, don't become like him. What a goof off, what a jerk, everything just hedonistic, living in New York City, the center of hedonism, you know, for North America, and because it has everything you could want, you know, if you want to have hedonic pleasure. He got totally sucked up in that. And he met, and he's, you know, he's from the Buddhist background, his brother's a tuku and all of that, so he'd met various lamas. There's no real impact. And then he met the 16th Karmapa. He said, poor. Then everything changed. Then just that, that's it. He just met that one person. Okay, this is it. Show's over. New start, reboot. Shut the whole thing down. Reboot. I'm going to become a monk. And I'm not only going to become a monk, I can't become a monk like most monks, living in a monastery, doing all kinds of stuff. I have to be a monk and go immediately into full retreat and be only contemplative monk. No other hope. I changed everything. He's a sublime monk. So pure, so joyful. He just lives in eudaimonia. His mind is just always cheerful. I know him. What I'm saying is actually true. So benevolent, so kind, just a flowing of kindness, a flowing of happiness, you know. Just flowing in a river of eudaimonia. Meeting one man turned everything around. Okay? Not the only one. So, nothing so quick to change as this chitta. Monks, this chitta is brightly shining. That's clear light. This monk, this mind is clear light, brightly shining. Papasaram, chitta papasaram, papasaram chitta. But it is defiled by adventitious defilements. So it's brightly shining, but defiled, it's obscured, it's covered over, it's veiled by defilements that come and go, right? When they go, well, there we just leave it at that. Monks, this chitta is brightly shining, but it is free. So this chitta is brightly shining, but it is defiled by adventitious defilements. Monks, this chitta is brightly shining, but it is free from adventitious defilements. What he's saying there, it's always brightly shining. It's not an appearance like the weather, that's sunny and then it's cloudy and it's stormy and it's calm. It's always there. It's always brightly shining. It's always pure. Covered, not covered, right? So when it's not covered, then virtue comes out quite spontaneously. And the adorability and the friendliness, the virtues and so forth. Oh, that person's such a nice person. I like that person a lot. And then it gets obscured by the defilements. Oh, I can't stand that person. Disgusting, unappealing, so unattractive. Don't want to be that. Ugh, that person makes me want to throw up, you know? But what's always there between the adorable person and the unadorable, disgusting person is that brightly shining mind always there, right? And it can be so quick to change and so full of possibility when developed and cultivated. We're looking into the way of presence, the way of abiding. What abides throughout the whole course of a lifetime, from our worst days to our best days, and then the boring days? What's always there? And then from the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a passage there that implies that loving kindness, this is going to repeat, but now listen to it afresh, implies that loving kindness is a quality of the brightly shining mind. And says it leads a person to meditatively develop one's citta. That's caring, right? Why would you develop your mind when you could just go out and get drunk? Or ride a motorcycle really fast, or see a great movie, or listen to wonderful music, or go party, party, party. Why would you do that? Because you care. And you've already kind of got figured out, that doesn't go anywhere. Cultivate your mind, and this yearning of caring, of loving kindness, could actually lead you where you want to go. It's a deeper, more wise caring than simply pursuing immediate sensual gratification. And so it leads a person to develop one's citta. It is that impulse of caring. This passage implies that the brightly shining citta, which is always there to be uncovered, is already endowed with loving kindness, providing a sound basis for any conscious development of this quality. So Amid asked a very good question by internet once, by email. And that is it not true, though, that this bhavanga, the substrate consciousness, is widely regarded as ethically neutral? Ethically neutral. Because from this can come out anger. From this can come out loving kindness, virtue, non-virtue, mental afflictions, wholesome mental states. And it just carries on constantly. So doesn't that mean it has to be ethically neutral? Because it can give rise to everything, from the most vile to the most, you know, demonic and angelic. And the answer is, yeah, the substrate consciousness is ethically neutral. The bhavanga is ethically neutral. But then the question, very very keenly proposed, well, then how can it be ethically neutral and of the nature of loving kindness? And I responded to this now very, very briefly. It's an interpretation, clearly. But something can't simply be of the nature of loving kindness and ethically neutral, because loving kindness is a virtue. That's it. It's on the positive side of the ledger. But when you've so, how do you say, dissolved the coarse mind with all its complexities and so forth, dissolve that into the subtle continuum, you're one giant step closer to Buddha nature. All that stands between you and resting in Rigpa is just two veils of clouds. One is the reification of your own mind stream. That's the concrete. You know, resting there and not being able to go deeper because you're reifying this. This flow of subtle mind with its bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. Reify that, grasp onto that, tenaciously hold to that. That'll keep you stuck. So there's one obscuration. Even if you break through that with vipassana, which is where we're going soon in this text, and you realize the emptiness of inherent nature, of your own consciousness, your own subtle mind, you realize the emptiness of that. That's big. Now you've realized shunyata, not just the substrate, which is a mere vacuity. And yet, if you're still conventionally identifying with this subtle continuum of consciousness, which is the stream of consciousness of a sentient being, empty of inherent nature, if you're still identifying with that, that's me, or that's mine, or that's my basis, if that's still the basis of designation of you, which it very easily can be, our coarse mind can be the basis of designation. If we say, I'm intelligent, I'm stupid, I'm worried, I. The basis of designation is fluctuations, activities, of course, mind. Well, on subtle mind, even if you realize it's empty of inherent nature, that doesn't mean you become obliterated. There's no person any longer. Your basis of designation, having achieved shamatha and even insight into the emptiness of your own mind stream, can still be that subtle, empty of inherent nature mind stream, basis of designation, where you say with confidence, I am a sentient being. Not inherently, but I am a sentient being. Fire is not inherently hot, but it's still hot. And I'm not inherently a sentient being, but I am still a sentient being. And there's where I stand. That's the final obscuration. That's also an obscuration. Because if your resting point is there, then Rigpa will be an object of your mind. Right? An object of your intellect, which in fact, of course, it can't be. So then Rigpa is reduced to a mere potential. I am a sentient being, empty of inherent nature, and I have the potential to one day in the future achieve enlightenment. So I'll strive diligently. And that's what the stage of regeneration and the stage of completion are for. It's a system that works. Wouldn't kick it, wouldn't knock it, wouldn't criticize it. I don't. But what I learned 20 years after I began studying Dharma is that it's not the only show in town. It's not the only avenue. That's a developmental approach. There's a discovery approach. And that is where you release even the subtle grasping, not reification, just the identification with or the imputation, this is the basis of designation of myself as a sentient being. And you make a conscious choice. You see that there's a choice. If you think there's no choice, then you don't have one. But if you see, as His Holiness said, Longchen Rabchenpa is giving teachings on Dzogchen as if from the perspective of a Buddha, where Tsongkhapa is giving teachings of the path as if from the perspective of a sentient being, then you say, oh, you mean there's a choice? I'm not locked into only one possible reality, and that is when all is said and done, I've got no choice about the matter. I am a sentient being. You mean there's another perspective? And the answer is yeah. Where your subtle continuum of consciousness is right now, which is the subtle continuum of consciousness of a sentient being, that's just true. Where that is, that subtle continuum is permeated, completely suffused by Rigpa. They're both there. They're both there. So now it's your choice. You're going to designate yourself. That just happens. Even when you're a Buddha, you still designate yourself. Right? The Buddha referred to this Buddha, that Buddha. One great Lama will refer to another Lama, and so forth. And then refer to themselves. But then you see, you have a choice. If I'm not inherently a sentient being, then I'm not just covering over an inherent sentient being with make-believe. Now I'm Vajrasattva. Now I'm Manjushri. Now I'm Padmasambhava. Make-believe. Like children playing cops and robbers. Not like that. No. That subtle continuum of consciousness, which is the continuum, is not a human being. It's not a sentient being. It's simply a continuum of consciousness. But right where it is, there's also Rigpa, the indwelling mind of clear light. That's my new translation through collaboration with a good friend of mine in America. That innate mind of clear light, then I went to primordial mind of clear light, and I'm going to indwelling. I think it's best. Subtly, they're all fine. But where that subtle continuum is, there is the indwelling mind of clear light. And now I choose, since I know the other one is empty, of inherent nature, that subtle continuum is not by its own nature the necessary basis of designation of me. It's one of myriad options. Because I could also have the basis of my body or my face or my intelligence. None of them are inherently me. And so since I've got choice, then my choice is I'm going to designate myself on the basis of my own Buddha nature. And where my speech is the speech of the Vajra speech of the Buddha, where my body is the Vajra body of the Buddha, and I now choose right now that that is the basis of designation. And then you may cut through. Right to Rigpa, which is already there. That becomes a choice. So now it's quite late. Oh, terribly late. Too bad. This is all commentary on love and kindness, because that's what really matters. Right? We may or may not realize Rigpa in this lifetime, who knows. We can definitely in this lifetime realize loving kindness. And we can take it with us. But we have to recognize what it is and not confuse it, as society around us confuses it every day, in every way. Not everybody, but in general. I think it's a good generalization. So as we go and we settle the mind in its natural state, which is what we're going to do now, and then I can speak very little during the session. Settle body, speech, and mind in the natural state. Settle your awarenesses of nature. Settle in your own nature. Settle in your own natural state, which is the closest approximation today of resting in the Bhavanga, this brightly shining mind, pure by nature, permeated by loving kindness, and the source of the aspiration to proceed on the path to enlightenment. As you're resting there, you're resting in a mode of presence, a way of being that abides. Like the sun is always in the sky, day or night, cloudy weather, sunny weather, it's always there. You're abiding in that self-illuminating, sun-like quality of your own substrate consciousness. To answer the question from the comment, critique made by Amy, and why do we say it's loving kindness? Because it's so little veiled that the infinite loving kindness, the relative bodhicitta that springs spontaneously from the ultimate bodhicitta of Rigpa, is shining right through it. So as a metaphor, I think of the substrate consciousness as being like a lens, brightly shining, transparent, but a lens. But the light, when we say it's brightly shining, where's the light coming from? Is it originating like from a flashlight? Is it originating from the bulb of the substrate consciousness? And I would say, no way. If it were, if the luminosity of the substrate consciousness were originating there, then the luminosity of Rigpa would be unrelated, irrelevant, and separate. Right? So the sheer luminosity of the substrate consciousness is not originating from the substrate consciousness. It's a lens. And the luminosity of the substrate consciousness is pouring forth from Rigpa. And likewise, if as far as you can see in the Theravada tradition, the Pali Canon, there are no references to Buddha nature, is as far as you're willing to talk about, to probe, is the Bhavanga, then you say the Bhavanga is brightly shining. Because there's no references to Buddha nature, to Rigpa, primordial consciousness, in the Pali Canon. But if you do have that broader view from the Mahayana, from Vajrayana, from Dzogchen, then the very light of the substrate consciousness stems from the indwelling clear light of pristine awareness. So Buddha nature. And then likewise, then it's kind of obvious. What appears to be loving kindness emanating from the substrate consciousness, well, it's not emanating from the substrate consciousness. Otherwise, the relative bodhicitta that emerges spontaneously from Buddha nature would be irrelevant, separate, disconnected, not related. And so the loving kindness that is the very ground state of that, or permeated, that substrate consciousness, and the yearning to cultivate the mind, to set out on a path, the yearning, that quiet yearning for liberation, for freedom, for something more, as the Dalai Lama said, that yearning for something more, whether religious or non-religious. You find it, if you plumb only as deep as the substrate consciousness, you find that there. That deep impulse of caring, that deep impulse for transcendence, for loving kindness, for bliss, for clarity, you find it there. But all of this, that's a lens, and all of that is coming from the ultimate ground. So the lens is ethically neutral. The ultimate ground is transcendently non-dual. So, the lovable. This dimension of every sentient being is constant. Crocodiles, human beings, orangutans, people manifesting in evil ways and wonderful ways. It's always there. It's a way of abiding on a relative level. It's a way of abiding. It's always there. And the mother, to go back to the analogy I gave, the mother gazing, I quite consciously did not choose the mother gazing at her child who's cheerful and giggling and just so incredibly adorable. I didn't give that example. I gave the example of her child asleep. And then the little child's friend in the next bed over, asleep. Right? So there's really, between two sleeping children, there's, you really can't, apart from just fear face, you know, physical beauty, there's no difference. I mean, if one's adorable, the other one's adorable, right? And so it's attending to something deeper than my child is prettier than your child, or my child is more likable, more pleasant, more cheerful, and so forth. No, it's not there. That's not it. The mother's seeing with her heart and not just with the eyes. She's not doing a beauty contest. My child is actually a bit more attractive than that child, or more pleasant than that child, and so forth, smarter than that child, more precocious than... No. Child's asleep. She's seeing with the eyes of wisdom, seeing with the eyes of the heart, that there's someone who's lovable there while deep asleep. The child's mind is rested in natural state. The child's mind is resting in Bhavanga. That's what you have when you're asleep. It's all that's there, Bhavanga, right? So in this meditation that we're finally going to get to our best approximation, rest in the Bhavanga, but knowing this is not simply a matter of faith, that one day if you're really good and you achieve shamatha, then you'll discover what you don't have a clue about now. A lot of you here already know that's not the case. A lot of you just doing a simple practice like mindfulness of breathing or any of the methods we're doing have already found at least spikes of bliss coming up. You didn't have to wait for, you know, a year, 5 years to achieve shamatha. You already know that's true. Other ones resting there, you found surges of loving kindness coming up, of serenity coming up, of stillness coming up, of a sense of well-being coming up, a sense of purity of the mind coming up. Then, of course, it gets obscured. It gets covered over again. We dredge the psyche, more stuff comes up. But we keep on getting glimmers, like the cloud patterns shifting in the sky and shafts of light coming down and then getting covered over again. But then you see, okay, this isn't coming from nowhere. These are not manufactured by my intelligence, my coarse mind. This is something streaming up from a deeper level. And it's good. It's good. There's the bliss. There's the luminosity. There's a non-conceptuality. There's a sense of well-being. There is benevolence, there's loving kindness. And beyond all the vicissitudes of the adventitious obscurations and defilements, veiling and not veiling, that's your ground. And that is definitely lovable. And it's abiding all the time. Sometimes more evident, sometimes less. But it's always there. And when you know that, this is a big pitch for achieving shamatha. When you've achieved shamatha, then you just know this without mediation. I mean, you totally get it. And not only you got it at one time, but you can access it any time you like. You can access that continuum of your own consciousness, which manifests as being lovable. The javana, the activities that come out. See, bhavanga is when all the javana have subsided. And then you activate your mind, the javana, the activities of the mind come out. And some are pleasant, some unpleasant, some virtuous, some non-virtuous. We're back to that, appearances. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. But your ground is not a computer turned off. It's not a blank slate. It's not a vacuum. It's not nothing. It's not just flat neutral. It's not aloof indifference. The ground is luminous, pure, saturated by loving kindness and a deep, deep impulse of caring. And that's lovable. If you know who you are on that level, let alone cutting through to Rigpa, then no need for any of these words. But here on this level, which is not something we can just hope for one day, you know, we can really access this. Then you see, this is my ground state. This, when I'm resting in my natural state, here it is. When I'm resting in my natural state, I'm lovable. And I'm just resting in my natural state. I am already lovable. And it's not because I did something really nice or lovable. It's not obscured by tainted virtue. And it's not obscured by tainted non-virtue or mental afflictions. It's just what is always there. And what is always there is lovable. Right? If that becomes real, you really know that what we attend to is reality. If that becomes real, then when you gaze at the children, you say, of course it's real, I can see it right there. And that child, and that adult, and this adult. And you see all the appearances coming and going, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And you say, but as for me, so for you. This is you when you rest in your natural state. And that's lovable. And it's not self-centered detachment. And it's not fixation on appearances. Oh, so that was much more than I thought. Hopefully it wasn't a waste of time. So please find a comfortable position. With the foundation of taking refuge in your own Buddha nature, the ground state of your own awareness, and with the motivation of bodhicitta, step by step, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states. To the best of your ability, releasing all grasping. All grasping to the activities of the mind, all grasping to the coarse mind, the psyche. Releasing it into space. And rest in what remains. A simple flow of luminosity and cognizance, brightly shining, serene, pure. And permeated by an impulse of caring. Although this continuum of the subtle mind is not a person, it's not I, it's perfectly suitable to designate yourself upon this. It's a choice you can make, and it's a valid choice, one of many. This is who you are at a deeper level than your age, ethnicity, gender, the phases of your life, the myriad activities you've engaged in. This is abiding. This is the way you abide, the way you're present. The basis from which the manifold appearances emerge. As they say in Pali, the ground of becoming, the ground from which all the appearances of you manifest. But here's your home. Here's a deeper sense of your own identity. It is, and you are then, worthy of love, lovable. And you may apprehend yourself by designating yourself on the basis of this, on this basis of designation. It's as valid as any other, but this is more meaningful than most. And this flow of consciousness is already permeated by that impulse of caring, which easily manifests as loving kindness, just as easily as compassion. So let's highlight in this practice that positive valence of loving kindness. Attending to ourselves. Vividly aware of the wish to find happiness and greater happiness, greater fulfillment, supreme fulfillment. Knowing how quickly the mind can change and how malleable it is when developed and cultivated, the tremendous potential of the mind for transformation, for spiritual evolution, aware of all of this, and visualize, if you will, the deepest dimension of your awareness, your own pristine awareness, once again as a radiant orb of light at your heart, the source of the light of your Bhavanga, your substrate consciousness. The wellspring, the ultimate wellspring of genuine happiness and of loving kindness, the ultimate purity of your own being. Visualize this symbolically as an orb of light, and with each out-breath arouse the yearning. May I be well and happy. Hedonically well and genuinely happy. With every out-breath, imagine rays of light flowing forth from this orb, filling your entire being. Symbolic of the natural purity, the indwelling love and kindness, and the indwelling joy of your own mind stream, filling your entire being with every out-breath. And now consciously bring to mind, drawing from your own memory, your personal memory, events, occasions from your past that brought out the worst of you, where this brightly shining mind was deeply veiled by clouds of obscuration, its bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality manifesting as hatred, greed, delusion, the appearance, very negative, nothing lovable. Other people didn't see you as lovable, you didn't see yourself as lovable. Because you weren't. The appearances were not. But the appearances veil the deeper reality that was always there as it is now. So look upon these manifestations, these embodiments, these reincarnations of yourself in the past, which appeared in no way lovable. See through the modes of appearances to that which abides. Always abides. And with every out-breath, wish these manifestations of yourself also, that each one may be well and happy. That each one may be free of these obscurations and find the happiness that you seek. Then again cast your memory or your attention back to your own past, to those occasions when you manifested, you behaved in ways that were lovable, beautiful, virtuous, admirable. Where you could really feel good about yourself and like yourself. Where this brightly shining mind was less obscured. But see through the mode of appearances which come and go unpredictably. And attend to that dimension of your being that abides continually, always worthy of loving kindness, always lovable. And breathe out with every exhalation the light of loving kindness to these incarnations of yourself, free of self-centered attachment, clinging to appearances, seeing through them to a deeper reality, which is always lovable. And wish yourself well with every out-breath. can finally attend to those manifestations, those incarnations of yourself that were neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, neither attractive nor unattractive, ordinary. And see through the bland, neutral appearances to the underlying reality. And with every out-breath, homogeneously arouse the same aspiration, the same wish of loving-kindness. May you and all of your manifestations be well and happy. And breathe out this light of loving-kindness to yourself. Breathe out this light of loving kindness to all the beings you have ever been in the past, in this and in prior lifetimes. And breathe out this light of loving kindness to all the beings you will be, the incarnations you will take in the future. From beginningless to endless, breathe out loving kindness. Then release all appearances, all objects of mind, release all aspirations. And for just a short time, rest in the natural purity, in the little clarity of your own awareness. in Lunaso. So we began here in Tuscany at about a minute after 9 a.m. in the morning. So at 9 a.m., which was a minute after midnight on the west coast of the United States, which means we began on Mother's Day in the United States. Big celebration, Mother's Day. Day for remembering the kindnesses of mothers. So, good. So we just began Mother's Day. And a good time to reflect upon the kindness of mothers without whom our whole survival would be terminated. So, good. It's very good. But also we can internalize this. Not everybody's memories of mother is homogeneously positive. But where the other mother left off, because we're all adults here, so they're probably not really looking after us now, in the same way as when we were children, of course, we can look after ourselves, you know. And to bring that same quality of love that mothers so often bring to their children, bring that to ourselves as we are raising ourselves, bringing ourselves up, you know, bringing ourselves up in Dharma. We're already brought up hedonically. It's already happened. Better or worse, here we are, you know. But we continue growing, maturing spiritually until we're enlightened. So we moderners, I think actually modern and not just Western, it happens so often. We can be very tough on ourselves. I see it very, very often. Very, very often. Like, I know it because I've done it myself so much. But, you know, in spiritual practice, we can be so tough on ourselves. Sometimes harsh, sometimes quite stern, sometimes unforgiving. Sometimes unkind, like a very harsh parent. Time to stop that. The mind is very quick to change. So even if we've been doing that for a long time, you can stop. You know, like Bob Newhart, his $5 counseling for what, 3 minutes, I think, yeah? 3 minutes? Whatever the problem was, stop it! Worked for me. I really like that one. I could be a therapist. I can say that quite forcefully. Either pit or stop it, either one you like. I'm multilingual. You know. But there's some things we actually can stop. You know, and we can stop that. It's a bad habit. And replace a bad habit with a new one. And that is guide yourself in the practice like a loving mother. Ever patient, infinitely optimistic, infinitely loving. And persevering all the way through the end. Oh, and then the Tibetan word for Lama. Tibetan word Lama, which is the Tibetan translation for Guru. La means unsurpassed. Ma, as in virtually every language. Mama means mother. So etymologically, the word Lama means unsurpassed mother. So be your own unsurpassed mother. Yeah? Outside Lamas come and go. They die, they get old, they travel. Be your own unsurpassed mama. Be your own lama. Take no external refuge. Do not look for the Buddha outside yourself. From the Pali Canon right up to Dzogchen. Same method, same message. Oh yeah, very good. So, today the interviews will be exactly 1.5 hour late. Actually, exactly on time for today. They'd be late if it were yesterday. Cheerio, see you later.